Welcome, welcome, welcome. God, I started that really gravelly. Welcome, welcome, guys. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip, and this is episode 128 with Robert Sheehan, a fantastic actor and just generally lovely guy. We had a great chat, incredibly honest and open, told some stories that we both feel maybe he shouldn't have told and might get in trouble for telling, but that makes it all the more fun listening, right? So yeah, obviously I should mention that we're brought to you by Speech Development Records. SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com is where I have my website and I sell my merch and we sell amazing stuff. We've got a whole section of signed stuff. So we've got signed books, signed DVDs, signed vinyl, all sorts. But then we've got our winter stuff. We've got woolly bobble hats, we've got jumpers, we've got coats, we've got some great stuff. But as ever, the drunk cast continues to embarrass me by the absolute swarm from you lot at the first drunk cast merch. Yeah, I think a few sizes have sold out, but we've done three drunk cast designs, a Chris design, a Pip design, and a Stu design. And yeah, they've been going down rather well, so thank you for everyone buying that. I also want to mention, as we can't deny we're getting closer to Christmas now. Pause this podcast if you get a chance now, and go on Facebook or just Google Rob Alton. That's R-O-B, and then A-U-T-O-N. Letter from Father Christmas. It's on my YouTube channel. I've posted it a lot on Facebook as well. He's the new signing to Speech Development Records, and me and Tom, who I've done all my videos with, who I've had on the podcast, in fact. We did every video from Introduction onwards was me and Tom. Every video on the label, every video of mine, all me and Tom. We did a video for Rob, and it's one of the most amazing pieces I've ever heard. It's a 9-minute spoken word piece. We've obviously released his spoken word album, At Home with Rob Alton, or At Home with Rob. It's Rob Alton's album. It's fantastic. You're going to, I love it. I recommend you buy it. You can buy a signed CD from speechdevelopmentrecords.com or the digital download. We've also brought back At Home with Polar Bear, which was the first of the At Home series, and that's on digital download now at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. But yeah, check out that video, A Letter from Father Christmas by Rob Alton. That is something that you can do for free. And you will just enjoy it. I guarantee you enjoy it. I guarantee you share it. After that, if you do enjoy it, maybe consider buying the album and put some money back in the pockets of those who bought that. But the important part that I care about is you watching it. And that's free. That doesn't cost you a penny. The same as this podcast. The same as every podcast I've done for the last 2 years. Free entertainment for one and all. So yeah, check that out. Let's get on with the podcast. It was great to sit down with Robert. His new film, Jet Trash, comes out on Friday, in fact. Friday the 9th of December. Check it out. I recommend you going and watching it. It's a wild ride. But we discuss it a lot in the podcast, so I won't give you too much preamble now. You're going to enjoy this, and I'll chat to you at the end, because next week we've got Michaela Cole on, who's fantastic. And yeah, I'll get back to you at the end. Let's get into the podcast. Let's get into the podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
Lovely.
And we are rolling. I'm joined today by Robert Sheehan. How are you?
Very well, very well. How are you?
I'm good. Are you on a bit of a press run, a bit of a trunket day, or is it relaxed and calm and enjoyable?
It's been apart from your wonderful tattooed self. Mm-hmm. It's just been one other interview, so it's been bad. Very laid back indeed.
Good, good, good. That's what I like to hear. And how is everything in general at the moment? Are you hectic and busy? It's always kind of interesting that when you're on, when an actor is promoting a film, it's normally or often one or two projects
detached from what you're on now. So you've kind of you've finished it, you've moved on, you're into this new exciting thing, and you have to go, oh yeah, remember that other exciting thing I did like a year or two ago.
Or almost 3 years ago.
Almost 3 years ago, damn.
Because this movie that that we're sort of showing off about at the moment was shot February, what year is it? 2016. It was February 2014.
Oh, wow.
That we shot this film. And because we were impoverished, you know, it took us ages. First of all, I mean, I think the post production process on Jet Trash took so long because, you know, everybody who had a creative say was all kind of, you know, they were all sort of throwing their two cents, and, you know, essentially arguments were flying back and forth as to what the picture lock was going to be.
Yeah,
and then I was away. I was living in California at the time, so I was getting cuts through, you know, and watching them on my telly. And it sort of, for a while, it felt like one step forward, three steps back. Oh, fuck, what's going on here? You know, we were making such progress, and then they've done all this shit. What's
it can
going
be
on?
Such a strange one when it's a strange and exciting when it is a project that, if the budgets are low, more often than not, everyone involved is hugely invested in it and hugely excited and wanting to be involved. Yeah. So it is a weird one because it means there will be a lot of different opinions. Mm. At points, if it's a massive Hollywood film or whatever, you've got three or four people who have the overall say. And that's, in a way, kind of easier as the actor at times to step away, I'd imagine, and go, right, well, they're going to make it into what they're going to make it.
And
we'll leave it there.
You're less invested when it's a large machine.
Yeah.
With this, I mean, myself and Charlie, particularly, once we sort of had the bones of the script, we developed it ourselves. And even during that point, it was interesting because I kind of learned how to be less possessive and territorial about stuff that I thought was good and become more open to ideas in the creative collaborative process. Because there were times when I was 4 o'clock in the morning with Charlie across my kitchen table shouting, going, what do you mean you want to leave that? What do you mean you're confused by that? Where is this coming from all of a sudden? And I had to sort of figure out how to be less aggressive and territorial with stuff that I liked in the script and open my ears more. And I think Jet Trash was a learning experience for that.
And
you know?
It can be a beautiful thing, right? Because when you start off in your head, I guess, you've got your visions and your views and it's kind of unwavering.
Mm.
It can be essential at points to have someone step in, even if it's just to make you justify why you've made that choice.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if it's not to talk you away from it. At times it can be to say, no, you're wrong. But at times it can be to say, well, tell me why you think that. Just to make sure it's not just an off-the-cuff, a gut reaction. You mean it and you want to stand by and you want to fight for
it. And that's the thing. You have to choose your battles. You have to choose the... and really, I think it just develops your sense of awareness as to what... it refines your ability to like and dislike things and know why. You know what I mean?
How many things can you think of now that you argued vehemently over that you now see as virtually inconsequential to, because again in that moment you can get to that point where every tiny little thing it means the world, when in reality, as said, you choose your battles, you let that one go and you make sure that this is right. It's kind of
it was funny, you know. There was times when we did a scene, the first scene we shot, we then came back to a week later, and the scene was just, it was at the beginning of the film where we see the two lads coming back to the beach in India, and they're sort of in this relaxed, lazy lifestyle. And oh, hang on, here comes Mr. Decaffeine. Hello, Decaffeine.
It's the coffee delivery. No worries. Thank you, sir.
I'm on the decafs at the moment, Pip. Because,
good work.
Because I'm trying to show Mr. Caffeine that he's not in charge of me.
Is Caffeine been
trying to take back control?
I've been bossing you. I do. There's another podcast on my network. If you've got any flights coming up, I always think podcasts are good for flights or travel. There's a podcast on my network called Say Why to Drugs. And it's not anti-drugs or pro-drugs, but it's me sitting down with a doctor and she picks a different drug each episode and breaks it down and says the pros and cons, the actual facts, dispels all the myths. And we just did caffeine and it was one of the most popular ones.
Really?
I mean, I say it's weird. It's obvious. The most popular ones have been alcohol, tobacco, and caffeine because they're the three most common. Yeah, but then the most interesting have been like MDMA and hallucinogens and cocaine and all these. And
at the end of the podcast, me and the doctor, we take a couple of crystals and go down the disco.
That's kind of the thing that makes me laugh the most is every podcast, and if you listen to a lot of podcasts, you'll hear them always say, subscribe to the podcast. It really helps and all this. The Say Why to Drugs one, I recommend people to subscribe to just for the comedy value of it. Because you get a notification that comes up that says, cocaine is now available from Say Why to Drugs. MDMA is now available. So it's kind of just for comedy value.
This podcast, you won't have to take coke this weekend.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, you're off the caffeine to take control back, right?
Yeah, and I went through about 2 or 3 days of going to bed about 7:30 in the evening.
Yeah.
And then waking up about 11 the next day, my body just shook with the lack of energy.
It's a drug and addiction.
Yeah.
It's something you can become completely dependent on.
The thing is, right, and I don't know if other people have noticed this, but I came out of the 2-3 day slump out the other side and have more consistent energy than ever through like things like porridge and fruit and eggs.
One of the facts I learned was that caffeine in general, it's your addiction to caffeine that allows caffeine to give you energy. If that makes sense. Mm. So if you've never had coffee, you drink some coffee, it's not going to give you that much energy. Right. But if you're a regular coffee drinker, it brings you down energy levels and caffeine brings you back up. So really, what you're probably experiencing now is the fact that you're constantly at the level that coffee would normally bring to
you,
or there and thereabouts.
Yeah.
It's because you're not... The drinking of caffeine is effectively addressing your almost hangover or withdrawal.
Yeah.
Your withdrawal from that drug. But we're not here to just talk about caffeine. So I'll continue on. Normally, I jump into kind of how your career started and early projects. And I do want to talk about other stuff because Misfits was amazing.
I've always wondered, right, where did the Scroobius part of your name come from?
It all comes
because
from...
Because we also, just for... listeners, we have a third party in the room.
We do.
We have a mustachioed baker in the corner there called Joe.
I'm a silent baker. I told you what I'm doing.
Yeah.
He likes to fill croissants with his secret cocktail.
I'm just enjoying the Christmas party vibe we've got here. It's like we've got a plate of crisps.
There's an untouched plate of crisps, a plate of biscuits.
I know, they're going stale rapidly.
Yeah, it's at the end of term.
Someone eat them.
Yeah. Gonna go and find the spoiled kids and see if I can have a go on their Game Boy.
But anyway, I said that to Joe the other day. I said, "What about the Scroobius part of his name?" And he said, "Ah, that's a word, mate." And I went, "Use it in a sentence." And he goes, "Look over there, Scroobius Pip."
That's solid use in a sentence. I nicked all of it from an Edward Lear poem.
Oh, right.
Which again. I used to tell this story, and the poem is about an animal that wakes up in the jungle and doesn't know what it is, and it goes with the fish for a bit, then realises it isn't a fish, and it goes with the lions and realises it isn't a lion, and goes with the birds and realises it isn't a bird, and then in the end it realises it is simply a Scroobius Pip. It's its own creature. It can exist in all these worlds, but it's its own,
really?
It's its own thing, and that's okay.
Oh, that's good.
And I was using that because I was doing, you know, at the time I was making some short films, I was doing street art, I was doing music, I was doing a load of things.
You were in a relationship with a gerbil.
I was in a relationship with a gerbil and I wanted to know that was okay. but I tell people that and they'll think, obviously, I'm incredibly well-read, but I first saw the name Scroobius Pip in a book on the counter when I was working in HMV. That was a book of dog and cat names. so that's actually where I found it. And then I read the poem and went, oh, I'm taking that. That's a
good
name.
That's where it's coming from. Yeah.
It's not as smart as it sounds. but yeah, I do want to go for everything else, but I'm excited to start off with Jet Trash because it sounds like there was a lot going on and it was a hell of an experience. So starting off, kind of, was this the most involved you've been in a project from the start?
Because
it seemed that you were brought in when it was the bare bones of a script and kind of like, look, you're the guy.
Yeah.
Now we need, that's all we've
now
got
so far.
Now we
need to build from a grassroots level. The project all together.
Which I think can be the best at times. It seems to be what Shane Meadows will do and a lot of people like that is rather than overwrite the character find the character. It's based on a book originally, isn't it? It's based on a true story.
Based on a couple of chapters from a book from the 90s called Go, by a guy called Simon Lewis. And there's a couple of chapters that took place in the UK and India before then. The book then carries on with the character of Saul, actually, who goes off to, I think it's Hong Kong. Right. So the book sort of just meanders through the world, like sort of one character meets another, intertwines and the story carries on. So we focused on the UK-India bit.
Nice.
Yeah.
And so what was the process of getting it all together, and kind of like how long was this something that was in your life until you started to actually shoot and create it? Or was there a lot of back and forth? And
there was endless back and forth. Yeah. Because I think, you know, because the production was always going to be one of modest means, they came to me and they said, I think they said to themselves, we will make the project more attractive by also offering Robert like an executive producer role.
Yeah, yeah.
But then because I suppose
the old ego. It's a classic trick. Exactly, I love it. Yeah. I've gone for it many times.
You'll be the deputy vice president of the movie.
Go ahead.
Then I suppose I stuck my foot further in the door than they were expecting and started becoming involved more in the creative sense. I mean, the only fundraising stuff, in truth, that I did, I mean, the main head honcho producer is a guy called Andy Brunskill, and he was the guy that was putting together all the logistics and doing a lot of the grown-up stuff. I mean, trying to move a British production to India with a Finnish actor, a French actor, you know, English actor, Irish actor, and trying to get visas for all of them. Wow. I mean, all of that stuff is insane. Actually, right? Here's one of the first hiccups of the production. We went down to the Indian Embassy in Old Street in London. Yeah. And we were down there and we were trying to get visas, just like three or four of us, to go over and do location scouting about 3 months before we did the film. And there was me, Charlie, the director, Andy, and a guy called Josh, who was location manager. And Andy Brunskill, who's supposed to be the responsible one, he left his bag in the embassy.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
And he,
I bet they don't like that.
Yeah. Right? We were in the taxi going back to the production office and he went, oh, shit, I've left my bag. It's okay. I'll get Victoria from the office to go and collect the bag later this afternoon.
Oh, wow.
So then Victoria went down about 3 o'clock and the whole embassy had been locked down and the bomb squad had arrived. I mean, she just came up and she went, oh, yeah, that's my boss's bag. Sorry. They're like, oh,
they don't like that in train stations, let alone embassies, let alone national embassies.
Yeah, we knew we were in for quite an eventful ride when that was how we kicked off. I got off point. So then the script came in, and actually the script was written by Simon Lewis, who wrote the book.
Yeah.
We commissioned him to do the script. And another guy called Dan Brown. And so the script was given. It was good shape. But then we sort of, myself and Charlie particularly, we had about 50 million ideas together. So we started to add the ideas and started to play with them and kind of add complexity to the film, you know, to make it. I mean, the film is in its, I mean, it is a sort of an action thriller type piece. Yeah. But we wanted to make the film as characterful as possible, you know. So we did months of work on the script, you know. And so, from a creative standpoint, my role went from executive producer to producer. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Because to actual real life a producer.
Yeah, because really, if people aren't in the industry, executive producer tends to be, you might have, for tax reasons, given a movie $25,000.
Yeah.
Or you're just, hello. Sorry, I've just seen someone through the glass of the office.
Yeah. Or it could be simply to add some muscle, to add a name and things like that in there. So, but actual producer, it's like, wow, you've got to do some work. You're going to have to really
I think I just turned around in the office one day and went, Andy, I want to be a producer. And he went, okay. So that was that.
And it doesn't seem to have calmed down along the route, along the journey of the film. From that tumultuous start, it doesn't seem to have calmed. There's a few things that I saw listed in the press release. Where to start? Let's start with stumbling upon a decapitated body.
Oh, yeah.
Thankfully, that wasn't me. That's a good place to start, right? But that was that would have affected production slightly, right?
Do you know what? Here's the bizarre thing. It didn't.
It really didn't. Oh, wow.
That's how... It was a strange time because we met this English guy who had this nightclub, this outdoor nightclub, right. Because there are lots of noise laws in Goa.
Yeah.
So the real clubbing situation is out of the urbane areas and it's out in the countryside. So there's this place called Leopard Valley, and this English guy had built quite a sort of a gaudy, tacky sort of nightclub with these kind of Roman pillars that shoot fire. Right?
Amazing.
The decks.
Amazing.
We were like, perfect. This is perfect.
Just as the Romans would have wanted.
Yeah, they were real. They were very camp, the Romans, you know. Look at the togas. So that place, we were like, this is the perfect location. He was all up for having his club in the movie.
Because that's it, because the movie is, we've not even touched upon what it is. It is a film of decadence and exploration and intrigue, I guess.
Yeah.
From what I've read, again, I'm watching it next week, which I'm looking forward to.
I'll send you the link.
It's easier, I can stay at home.
Yeah, exactly. and exploitation. I think that was
right. Yeah,
that was. The trash part of the title. I think we wanted to show the boys sort of exploiting India at large. The welcoming India, the India that sort of takes in people from around the world. And allows them to explore its beautiful spiritual places and in whatever fashion they like,
And through Brits yoga, turn up and put up
Roman
towers and shoot fire from
sell,
it.
Exactly, yeah. Another dickhead sell drugs there, you know. But the decapitated head was on our last night in Leopard Valley in this club.
Yeah.
Someone, because we were shooting kind of in and around the club, like the club was sort of ongoing.
Yeah.
And there were people who knew that we were filming and there were people who didn't, you know what I mean? And it was mad.
I love the beauty of low-budget films.
Totally guerrilla.
Of that kind of just, let's just make it happen. Let's ask for forgiveness before permission.
Yeah, exactly. And so
get away with this.
We had, we were sort of running in and around the behind the deck. So we were kind of, we wanted to use the surrounding landscape and sort of let off flares. Charlie wanted to have a kind of a surreal thing where there was these strange fireworks in slow motion and kind of give it a surreal feel. And then someone stumbled on a body.
Wow.
Like just as we were leaving, just as we were finished on the last night.
God damn.
Without a head.
Yeah. Wow.
And called the police, and apparently he was some guy from a gang, and there was not much of a deal made of it.
No, that's and kind that of there. Well, there you go. That's that.
Yeah. I mean,
that's happened.
It is India is a beautiful place, and I don't want to slag it off, but there is an undercurrent of, I think, what's the word? Danger.
Yeah.
You know, there's definitely
a lawlessness.
Yeah. There's a thin veil of civility.
It's the sad thing, isn't it, that anywhere that's kind of based around a level of freedom and spirituality is therefore open to exploitation.
Yeah.
It's open to go in and go, all right, well, no one's really governing this. Let's go and do what we want there. It's a sad reality with humans, I guess.
Huge parts of northern Goa have been completely taken over by Russian businessmen.
Yeah.
And, like, huge stretches of the coast that, like, have Russian casinos, Russian hotels where they only speak Russian.
Wow.
And sort of in a private way, they have commandeered a large section of India to sort of fear and chagrin of Indian people there. You know, they're like, this is scary because they've just taken a large section of Goa. It's mental, just because they have money.
Speaking of commandeering, another thing that was noted was something about crew holding cast hostage or holding actors hostage in some way or some manner. What was?
Yeah, there was a guy.
I'm going to make you roll your eyes many times doing this. I've maybe got too much information here. It's like,
That's where one where obviously someone's teased you with not enough information.
Right.
But there was a guy on our crew who had, unfortunately, he had a check out from reality because I think of a cocktail of anti-malaria medicine and alcohol that was swirling around in his system.
Yeah.
He had a full-on psychotic episode, right?
Damn.
I mean, his name was Dan, actually.
What are the chances?
And that's all I'm saying, right?
Well, there you go.
yeah, but what happened was he was sort of acting really strangely all morning, right?
Yeah.
And then we were doing this scene, just about to go for a take. And then just from about 50 yards away, he came sprinting at me and dived on me and then held me down. He managed to get sort of under me, held me down by the chest and neck and going, "Rob! Rob, it's in their eyes! It's the Indians! It's the Indians!" I was going, whoa, whoa, because he's a kind of an eccentric, funny dude anyway. Yeah. I was like, all right, Dan, this isn't funny. This is just, funny. I don't know what the joke is here. And he wouldn't let go. And then it became like, oh, Jesus Christ.
This is a thing.
He's seriously taking hold of me. But we had a security guy and, you know, a couple of other people. And they just dashed in, grabbed him, dragged him off, lifted him. And they put him in the back of a car. And then they had to drive him to a hospital.
Yeah.
And what he told me afterwards was that on the way to the hospital, he felt like the devil was going to be around every turn, right?
Oh, wow.
Like, genuinely. And he thought that the whole entire production was an elaborate ruse to basically veil the fact that we were going to decapitate him, that we were going to kill him. Right?
Yeah, I mean,
and then he was
already done your decapitating for the trip. It was like, I was dealt with.
And then they took him to one of these sort of secure hospitals, and because he was flailing about so much and erratic, they had to strap him down. So imagine what was going on in his head then.
Yeah, like completely.
These doctors, and then they syringed him to try and sedate him.
Jesus.
He went through a horrible experience.
I mean, it's really, people don't give enough credit at times to the genuine risks and tests, I guess, of shooting in deserts, in places of extreme heat. Extreme medication there can be, and things like that. I remember hearing numerous stories about The Last Mad Max, how they were shooting it all out there. And obviously the director was the original Mad Max, the director. But when they did the first ones, he was a lot younger. And a lot of the crew were the same people. But it's taxing physically on a human. Yeah. And that, I mean, I think it overran by quite a bit. But for all completely valid health reasons and risk reasons, like of everyone involved. Because it's like, right, we're going to go and what we're trying to do is shoot this crazy dystopian wasteland. It's like
giant action.
But that means you're going to a crazy dystopian wasteland. Yeah. That's like, there's a reason that's the image of the end of the world. It's because it's a really hard place to exist and live. And I'm sure it'd be similar in India and in particularly if you're going out into secluded parts where, again, you're going to have huge amounts of heat, huge amounts of dehydration and, as you said, all sorts of vaccination and
Sophia,
and whatever else.
Who's in the film? Yes. She's my girlfriend.
Yes,
and she was just shooting in the Namib Desert where they shot Mad Max.
Yeah,
and the first picture she sent back, she sat in a Canada Goose coat in the desert during the day. I was going, "What the fuck?
Yeah,
what is it cold there?" She's like, "It's freezing." It's one of the weirdest parts of the world,
isn't it?
Yeah. Because I mean,
variation
I'm sure
in heat levels.
Yeah, because they were shooting at the sort of autumn time, so I suppose it was cold by that point in the desert. So that place gets like suffers extreme cold and extreme heat, you know. And that movie was shot for months and months and months, didn't it?
It's scary. So the final thing that came up on the list of anomalies when shooting was the almost fatal overdosing of a stunt cow. again, it's a hell of a sentence I never expected to say, but, you know, in the story, there's a cow that takes drugs, isn't there? Or some kind of... is that some kind of scenario there, right?
We had to convey that there was a dead cow.
Right.
So this guy showed up with a cow, a far too old cow. The cow was supposed to be a calf.
Yeah.
And he showed up with a near adult cow, right?
Yeah.
Because in the script, because I'm sort of in a reverie and I'm sort of a little bit on drugs. And so this cow, you know, according to my character, comes out of nowhere and I crash into it with my moped.
Right.
But, you know, in truth, I'm just not paying attention.
Yeah.
And so then, as it was written, we then take the cow and we drag it off into the ditch beside the broken moped. And then we all, you know, jump on the other moped. But then he brought this big cow, and we were like, oh Christ, okay, right, get some pallets and attach some wheels to the pallets so that we can try and roll this cow up the road.
Yeah.
But then that we didn't need the pallets because the cow wouldn't go to sleep, right?
Right.
And and this is the other charm of shooting in India, is that, you know, you tell the production, we need a guy who can administer ketamine to a cow, like a vet, and bring the cow to set. Can you sort that out?
Yeah.
And then some dude shows up with a cow.
I'll do it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, they get probably like their brother-in-law or something to go get a cow and get some ketamine, right? So this already charlatan got some. Shows up, right? And he administers the ketamine, administers a double dose, and then a triple over the course of the scene.
Yeah.
Because every time we went up to the cow and picked up its hooves, it would start kicking out at us. So it just wouldn't go to sleep. And it was like a massive amounts of ketamine coursing through its veins.
Yeah.
So then we had to quickly rewrite the scene where I pick up the leg and I go, no, no, God, no, it's too much. I can just leave it. We'll just leave it. Fuck it. You know. And then we just jump on the, well, we don't jump on the moped because Mike, the monk character, jumps on the moped and just abandons us on the road. So that was the drama of the cow. And of course, the other thing is that the crew, chiefly Hindu, you know, were looking at how this cow was being treated and were getting increasingly upset as the day was going on.
Yeah.
And, we had to wrap up the cow pretty quick because we thought the crew were going to mutiny.
Yeah. This isn't going to end well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah,
The cow was fine after. It just looked a little buzzed, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean,
a few hours later, it was just quite zen, like over by some grass.
Incredibly relaxed at the end of it all. So, I mean, in many ways, having a journey like that to getting something completed must make it all the more rewarding when you've finally got to that finish point where you're like, oh, we've done it.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah.
Is there more excitement in this than maybe some of the previous project you've worked on?
Yeah, I think so, because you have more invested, you know, and also because you come with that investment, you come so close to catastrophe, you know, time and time again, even before you start shooting, that when it's finished and it's done and everybody's happy, and then you bring it to Edinburgh and then you get really good reviews, you know, it's a satisfaction and an elation that's profoundly deep. It really is, you know.
Amazing.
It's lovely.
So let's go see it. I mean, we'll plug it again at the end, but this is coming out on December 7th, and by chance, it's in cinemas December 9th, in View Cinemas, so it's kind of
perfecto,
perfectly timed. You'd think I was a professional. let's kind of rewind things back. You grew up near Galway, I think, kind of in...
Well, Galway. It's sort of, I mean, near Galway in the sense that where I grew up was rural.
But yeah.
In the geography of the island, I was nearer Dublin.
Oh, right, yep.
Leash is the county I'm from, and it's the one that's the most midland. It's right smack bang in the middle of the country.
Yeah.
And sort of, if you're driving down the country, it's on your way to Limerick, you know.
Yeah,
but nowadays, I mean, the trip.
You see how I dodged it there, because I'd looked at the name of where you're from, but I didn't know how to say the word Leash, because it's L. How's it?
L A O I S.
Yeah, that's it. That's where I'm like,
you dodged it, and I didn't even notice you dodging it. If you hadn't said anything,
I have to admit to that. But near Limerick and nearish to Dublin. So what kind of? What was it like growing up there? Were you always kind of drawn towards performing? Or was acting something you always wanted to do, or whatever?
I think not in a aware sense.
Yeah.
But I certainly used to completely engorge myself on movies as a kid. And
it can be the beauty of growing up in smaller towns and things like that.
I mean, an uneventful place.
Near to Limerick, I think, like, a Limerick is one of my favourite places in Ireland, but it's got a reputation for being a bit violent. It's, everyone who's not from Limerick will nudge you going, oh, you're going to stab city next day. It's like, I love it. And again, I grew up in Essex, so I'm used to rough and shitty areas. So, but growing up in small towns can, I think one of the greatest motivators can be boredom. And the greatest motivators to take in culture and to take things in. It can go the other way. You could end up
in the local pub seven nights a week and whatever else. But so you were kind of drawn to absorbing films and culture.
Yeah, and by no means was I did I hermit myself or anything. I mean, I was on the Port Leash, which is the main town in Leash. I was on the football team. Yeah. I was on the soccer team.
Yeah.
So I had sports as well when I was a kid. But funnily enough, when I did my first film when I was 14, that sort of coincided with all of a sudden I'm too small to make next year's team. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So being on the team kind of ended and acting began.
Yeah.
You know, all at once.
That's wonderful. Timing and combination there that you can kind of go, well, no, I'm leaving the team because I'm an actor now. It's not, I've not been muscled aside. It's very much my choice.
I'm not
leaving me.
Yeah, go out there and kick their heads in if I wanted, but I'll go off and be an actor instead.
Yeah.
So, but you know, and it's not very usual where I come from to become an actor. So I suppose people didn't fully know how to quantify me when I was a teenager and I was going off doing acting, sometimes for long stretches, you know. I mean, and the funny thing was the first, you know, this is the charm of growing up in Ireland, right? But the first film I did was a movie called Song for a Raggy Boy, and it dealt with the way young boys were brought up in Catholic reformatory schools in the 1930s.
Right.
Wow. You know, the physical abuse, the sexual abuse, you know, it showed it all. It was quite graphic, you know. And so when that movie came out, you know, it's like, oh, Jesus. And my character was like called O'Reilly in the movie. It's like, oh, Jesus, O'Reilly, watch out now. You're going to get bummed by a priest.
Yeah, that's going to be something, particularly in a small town. Yeah. You've suddenly got that notoriety for something that artistically is great, but yeah.
Yeah, it's like, hang on, I'm not even bummed in the film. They're still slagging me off.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I had to live that down for a while.
I mean, it's a really interesting one because Ireland is great for its production of local TV and cinema, like RTE and everyone else do a lot of drama that often seems to stay, it's by Ireland for Ireland kind of thing. But it can be a great learning ground and preparation, I'd imagine, because there is a lot put in there, but it's not that there's not as much competition. I guess there still is, but you'd think, you know, if you're growing up in London, for example, the amount of people all going for that same acting role or whatever else is endless, whereas it feels a little bit more, as you said, as it's not as obvious a goal growing up in small towns, it could be an easier route in at points to here we go.
It's absolutely true. You're right. I mean, the competition is far less, and I think if there is like a rural drama, and you are an actor from a rural part of Ireland with a few things on your CV, you know, you are in with a great chance, you know, to work and continue working. I mean, and Ireland's a fantastic place to work. I sort of wish I worked there more, in truth. You know, the last time I worked there, I was 24 going on 25. So it was like 4 years ago.
Wow.
On a TV show called Love Hate. And it's interesting as well because that show was really good. It was cracking telly, and I'm certainly not boasting. I was a small cog in the love hate machine overall, but the show itself, the writing and the pacing, directing and the editing was all fucking fantastic. But what's not quite there with Irish TV certainly is the means of international distribution, you know. Yeah.
And completely.
I
agree. It does seem unusual that there'll be so many amazing actors that, again, all suddenly appear. And you're like, wow. It's like, no, he's massive in Ireland. But this drama hasn't got out.
No, and it sort of saddened me about Love Hate. I mean, Love Hate was the biggest TV show in Ireland ever, right?
Wow.
And was it based
on anything true? Because again, another thing with Ireland is that it tends to be a lot of true Irish stories, it seems to be, and maybe that's why it seems to not distribute around. But so many people I meet who've done huge things in Ireland, it's portraying this amazing true story that means a lot to everyone who's watching it, means everything, and somehow just stays there.
I think before Love Hate, just before Love Hate, in the cultural consciousness, there was a huge awareness of all the gangland criminality that was going on, particularly in Dublin and Limerick, our old favourite place. And so this Love Hate reflected the gangland criminality. So, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, like all things, the media in Ireland, were massively sort of exaggerating the realities of the gang criminality. But it was happening, you know. And there are gangs that are bringing, you know, industrial amounts of drugs into Ireland, you know, cocaine particularly. So this show follows the exploits of a gang like that in Dublin.
Yeah.
And all the sort of the politics and the paranoia that go on between the characters and stuff. And then what's probably most interesting about the show is that there's a sort of a foot soldier character who Tom Vaughan Lawler plays called Nidge, who, as the show goes on, you see him in a very sort of insidious and weaselly way. You see him rise to the top of the ranks and become like this Napoleonic, like ferociously vicious kind of malevolent dictator of this gang. You know?
Yeah.
So it's a brilliant show. It's I a love brilliant, it. Brilliant show.
It sounds well amazing. Worth and I love when people make those shows that shine a light on the real versions of that. And Gomorrah, the series, was a recent one in Italy that was just absolutely amazing, just getting the real levels. And the fact is, Ireland, particularly as England firmed up their borders, became a huge thoroughfare for importation of drugs.
Yeah.
So again, there's going to be a lot of stories there.
Yeah.
A lot of dark shit that went on, but you know, a lot of interesting things. So
Stuart Carolan, the creator of the show, he said that no one could ever accuse him of hyperbole in the show because all of the stuff took place in the papers. You know what I mean? All of the stuff that the gang does.
Yeah.
You know, like everything from taking a grappling hook and attaching it to an ATM in a store, and then attaching that to the back of a Jeep, and then driving the ATM out the front window of the store. All amazing. That stuff happened. Or in the first series, where Brian Gleeson's character is showing off to some lads with a Glock pistol, and he takes the clip out, but there's still one left in the chamber, and he puts it to his own head and blows his brains out, right? That happened in Limerick. It happened to this guy, this gangster fella who was showing his 12-year-old son and the son's mate. He was showing off in a gun range, going, "No, you always take out the clip." And then he put the gun to his head and blew his brains out. You know, so
that's insane.
The show massively mirrored events that happened in Ireland, events that were massively covered by the news. So the show, in a way, the kind of the drama of it was quite protected, you know, by that.
Yeah, completely. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good show, man. Check it out.
Another show that obviously mirrored reality hugely was Misfits. Obviously, it didn't mirror. That's the joke. And
if you're looking for reality, you should watch Misfits.
But that's kind of, it seemed that that was your initial real big break. It was, it's the one that really thrust you into people's eyes.
Groups.
So how was that? Because it was what Channel 4 can be absolutely amazing at was making something new and original and raw with a lot of people who aren't that well known, aren't that established, and really just going, look, here's something that's really good.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And feeling like unapologetic and not trying to go, here's the names on our list.
Do
you know what I mean? It's just mark it off the fact, look, this is great. That's
true. I was incredibly lucky to be in that show, I think. I mean, I was incredibly lucky because, I mean, shows like that come along once in a blue moon, I think. And to be in that show and have such a good part in that show, it was career-wise, I mean,
I was really late to it. I caught it a few years, a couple of years ago. And now my girlfriend had recommended it. And I just binged the whole lot in no time at all. And it's one of those shows. It had that excitement and vibrancy. How much freedom did you have in that one? Because it felt, your character and Nathan, it had that feel that how much of this is scripted and how much is saying, well, just go off, just go mental, just go a bit nuts here, just say outrageous things and then we'll see what we can actually edit and work.
I wish it was the latter, although I think they covered the fact that I had that ability in the audition because they did stages of audition where there was improvisation, you know what I mean? So you bring your best comedy shit to the room,
yeah, yeah.
and, uh, and sort of make them laugh. So there was that stage. But in truth, man, everything was scripted. Everything.
Amazing.
You know, all those gags were really funny, really well developed, and I was just, I just was delivering them, thankfully, in an energetic and unique way.
I was going to say, I think it's a testament to everyone involved then, that it all felt so natural. It really felt like a bunch of mates were kind of...
Yeah, and that's what
it was. Not making it up as they go along, but kind of getting to dick about, and then at the end of the day going, good work on a good day at work. Like, yeah, really? Yeah. Brilliant.
Because they did, they let us dick about, sometimes to the detriment of the schedule.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
They let us dick massively about. Yeah. And I think we were sort of like the children in the production of that show. And they never once admonished us for not paying attention, or for not being on point, or for fucking up you know what I mean? There was never any...
Yeah.
I mean, they wanted to at times, right? At the end of a day when they're half hour over.
It's got to be that awareness that in a situation like that, as soon as the teacher tells you off, it's just everyone's going to get the giggles all the more. It's like often you need to let it play out. If you give everyone a telling off, then as soon as you roll on the next one, the first line is going to make everyone burst into tears of laughter. And
And the corpsing effect was something that plagued us continually, particularly myself and Iwan Rayon, who played Simon.
Yeah.
The two of us often would get to the point where we couldn't look each other in the eyes, you know, that thing without just
And he had to play
shake.
Such a straight role as well. So again, at least if you got smirky, it's kind of in the character, it's acceptable. Yeah. But he had to play such a dead straight role that must have been impossible.
Yeah, I secretly knew that as well. So torturing him.
So how was it when it came out and kind of and hit and the reaction was huge? Because again, I guess making it, you obviously had big expectations, but it is a show that's not got these huge names attached. So therefore, it's not a guarantee of success as such.
This sounds like propaganda in hindsight, but... I had no expectations.
Right, yeah.
Really and truly, I didn't even know what we were making.
Yeah.
And I'm deadly serious about that. You know, I mean, it wasn't until I watched the first episode and I went, oh, all right.
I see.
I sort of see the darkness and the drama of it now, yeah. Because apart from a few very carefully chosen moments, my character was just dicking about and being an arsehole to everyone. Yeah. And, you know, I embraced that with all my might. And
that must have been a fun role to get to do, because it is essentially, today you've got to say 12 really offensive things to your mates. You've got to insult them.
There was actually a rule on the show that we had one cunt per episode, right? And there was one...
I love those rules.
Yeah, I know. It makes zero sense. And there's one where we're sifting through a bunch of clothes that have been donated, and I find some ski goggles, some red ski goggles, and put them on. And I go, hey, guys, who am I? And start crooning like that. And he goes, all right, I'll give you a clue. I'm an annoying cunt. It's Bono! It's like, what a great use. And Bono, if you're listening, I don't mean it, I promise. Howard Overman means it. He wrote the script.
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, it's beautiful to have that freedom and that fun. And again, the beauty of shows like that is that they're now on Netflix or on 4OD or whatever, and kind of, it's that thing where even probably 10 years ago, you could have a show that you'll have its moment, and then that's it. It's kind of moved on from. Whereas now, they keep bubbling over, and that is one that feels that continued to feel fresh. And again, just to give a testament to everyone in the show, when you left, my thought was, and not to praise you too much, but my thought, I might drift off of this a bit now, because that was such a strong character, such an overbearing character, and then they happened to bring in someone like Joe Gilgan, who's completely different but equally a force of nature in it. So it's kind of, they were really good at finding the right people to go, no, we can, we got this. This is fine.
Yeah. I mean, I think what changed as well when I left was that the first two series, which I did, Howard, the creator of the show, wrote.
Yeah.
Through development, he wrote every script, you know.
Jeez,
But then the show became a staff of writers.
Yeah.
And I think what I mean, I don't know if this happens all the time, but I sort of felt like, through no fault of the actors or whatever, but I did feel like the writing became almost like a reflection of the show as opposed to the show itself.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
It could be an interesting thing where you're trying to write in that voice rather than having that voice.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
And
you're almost doing an impression of the show.
Yeah.
As such.
Yeah, exactly. And there was talk of a movie and they showed me the script of it. And again, the movie sort of took on the sentiment of the third and fourth series where the comedy wasn't about the fact that these people have these disabilities.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, look how funny we can make these powers, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that shift made it a bit more, I don't know, a bit more sort of less depth, I think, less about how will this normal person deal with this very odd disability. Now it's like, oh, look, I can pull a bouquet of roses out of my arse. How funny. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that shift, I think, happened after I left the show, you know?
Well, I mean, we touched upon, I said that I came to Misfits late. So the first thing I saw you in was A Killing Bono, which, again, it's funny that we've touched upon Bono already there and called him an annoying cunt. So, and now we're on to a film primarily about killing him for being such.
Just so we know, Joe is in the corner, red-faced, like shaking with laughter.
So how was that? Was that the first feature film that you were kind of thrust to the head of as such?
Let me think. Well, there was one before Killing Bono, where it was myself and Rupert Grint in the starring roles, which was called Cherry Bomb, which was shot in Belfast. And again, you know, as jobs go, that was just one of the most fun, anarchic gigs I've ever been part of.
Yeah,
it was loads of partying. Everybody was family really quick.
Beautiful.
You know, it was a beautiful thing.
Yes.
Like Misfits. So that was similar to Bono, because myself and Ben Barnes and Bono are brothers, and we, like brothers, we, you know, argue like tits and, you know, and we love each other. And myself and Rupert had a similar relationship in Cherry Bomb, even though we weren't brothers. So there was that. There was a kind of a string of jobs. What was it? It went Cherry Bomb and then a trilogy for Channel 4 called Red Riding Trilogy.
Absolutely adored Red
Riding. Yeah,
Red Riding. The cast again with Paddy Considine and numerous other people. That was a hell of a series. And it jumped, if I remember rightly, it jumped kind of timelines slightly. It was all kind of based around the same kind of era and town and thing and jumped ahead. And that was a great series.
It was cool. It was like, it was a quartet of books, which they adapted into a trilogy.
Yeah.
But, so there was that. And then there was a sort of a medieval action thriller with Nicolas Cage called Season of the Witch. And then Killing Bono.
How was working with Mr. Cage?
It was great, man. He has a childlike eccentricity, that man. He's one of the most interesting human beings I've ever. He's weird because he's obviously lived in a bubble of fame for a long time, but seems completely untouched by it. You know,
I think
like me, he's someone who could very easily live in the realm of fantasy for the rest of his life and be quite happy.
Yeah,
I'm like that. I think.
I was doing a series earlier this a year with Stephen Graham, and we hit it off really well. And he was saying of working with Cage, because I was like,
that was the same movie.
Yeah. And it was all, he was saying just craziness about up mountaintops, riding horses, just dangerous stuff. He was saying, I was like, how's Nicolas Cage? And he was exactly the same. He's like, he's Nicolas Cage. He's exactly what you expect Nicolas Cage to be. And it's a delight.
It's lovely. He's lovely.
It's a wonderful, eccentric, a weird existence, but
and I think kudos to him, because there's no barrier between him and you, you know, or anyone. Yeah. Like he's incredibly curious, kind. You know, he sort of wanders around asking questions. He asked me once, right? This is true. He goes, "What do you know about the mysticism of leprechauns?" Right? And we were sat in a castle, an abandoned castle, at nighttime in Austria, right, freezing. I don't know. And I said, I mean, they wear little green suits and they've got pots of gold at the end of the rainbow. about as much as you, really. Why? He goes, well, because I think my assistant, Michael, might be a leprechaun. Like, in all seriousness.
I love it.
And I said, well, why? You know, because Michael was quite small. He was quite a small man, slight of shoulder, right?
Yeah.
And I said, why? Because he's small. He goes, yeah, well, yeah. I mean, like, he's a small guy. And also because he was a baby in a basket found on a doorstep. So he has this, we don't know where he's from. He's like this magical creature. So I think God put him in my path to hire him because he's a leprechaun.
Obviously, that makes...
I went, oh, okay.
Good job.
All right, good. Brilliant. So that, like, that was the levels of supernatural belief, I think, going on in his head.
I love that there's a weirdness about him, but everyone I've heard, it's never a harmful or offensive weirdness. It's always sweet. Stuff like that, just walking in saying something absolutely batshit, but not to be rude, not to be arrogant, not to be offensive, just going, I think my assistant's a leprechaun. wicked, nice one.
Because he goes... He'd tell you things about his life as well, sort of personally. You'd sort of go, you shouldn't be telling me this, man. Because it's like he wasn't aware of how famous he is. You know
literally,
what I mean?
As I started on Stephen Graham, and I was about to say the story he told me, then realised, oh, no, I can't say that, because Nicolas Cage probably shouldn't have been saying that to the people that were there, let alone me, three times removed on a podcast. So, but that's kind of the openness that you tend to get the impression he'll stroll into a conversation and reveal something very personal.
Really?
And stroll off again.
It's actually a nice lesson, I think. Yeah. It's a nice way to
live. Beautiful openness, right?
Yeah.
A comfort within yourself that,
totally.
Unimaginable.
I try to do that. And also doing that cuts through the mainframe of people's politeness, I think, very quickly.
Yeah. Amazing. You know? So what do you know about the mysticism of leprechaun?
I know a lot now.
So what's ahead? I'll start to wrap things up as we're at the hour mark. But you're in the next series of Fortitude, which was just, it seemed to come out of nowhere, that first series, with one of the most stunning ensemble casts and just an eeriness and strangeness, a truly unique, in a weird way, it's comparable to Misfits in it came out with this feeling and vibe that wasn't like anything I've particularly seen before. It was very much an adult drama, but it had a weirdness and a mysticism to it. So so how was working on that? And was that another one where you're working in unbelievable climates and situations or challenging climates and situations, right?
We were at the end of the line in Iceland. You
Amazing.
Know, Reykjavik is sort of the southwest of the island. We were on the very, very far east coast where there's really next to nothing. There's some fishing there and there's a giant aluminium factory.
Wow.
And that's kind of it, you know. And so we were out there for the mountains, obviously, and the scenery. So we did 6 weeks there, 3 weeks and 3 weeks. And so, climate-wise, it was pretty mad and intense. And also, I said at one point to someone, I said, you know what, this environment is brilliant. It's a brilliant surround to have if you're playing a character that's batshit crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
So it really
How
lended
easy
itself.
To lose yourself kind of thing in a place like that.
And I played this guy who is a shaman. He's a young shaman who, without giving too much away, he sort of comes to the town and tries to... I don't know what I'm allowed to say.
We don't have to go into
into
too much again. That's kind of.
But he was a shaman, and Simon Donald, who's the creator of the show, always envisioned this character coming to the town, and you know, read up a lot on different traditions of shamanism all around the world, and.
Wow.
The levels at which these people could sort of divorce themselves from their physical form and sort of, you know, all of a sudden find themselves in the body of an eagle, a flying eagle or a bear, you know, these were the ways that that shaman worked and how they so this character sort of embodies a lot of the characteristics of old ritualistic shamanism.
It's what I loved in the first series of the kind of a lot of the mysticism or spiritualism in it, you'd have constant points of doubting, then points of believing. And that's it was beautifully written in that way, that it wasn't kind of going, oh, look at these silly ideas. It was going, oh, look at these silly ideas. Mm-hmm. Oh, hang on. Let's keep... Oh, hang on. That's not so silly. This is weird. The more you look at it, the more you're like, well, they're different. They are definitely doing that. And, you know, it's fascinating.
Yeah, and this series, I think, takes the horror of the show to another level.
Amazing.
Like, it's like a series of horror.
Yeah. You know?
It really is.
Fantastic. And do you know when that's out? Is that the end of this year or beginning of next year?
Beginning of next year. Yeah, January, I believe.
It's always a tough one with actors, because to ask or what's next or what you're working on, because there's often stuff you can't talk about and so on and so forth. So is there anything you're working on at the moment that you can talk about or can reveal, or should we leave that there?
I'm not supposed to, but fuck it.
Brilliant, go ahead. That's what I like to hear.
I'm doing a movie called Mute with Duncan Jones.
Duncan Jones, kind of the follow-up to Moon, isn't it? With Skarsgård and Paul Rudd.
Skarsgård, Paul Rudd, and, Justin Theroux.
Justin Theroux, yeah.
Yeah, and moi.
Amazing. That's all.
I got an email last night from they're going to kill me for this.
It's fine.
Got an email going, you know, it's probably not fun to say not much. So if you're happy to not say anything, thanks. You know, like the most diplomatic don't say anything
email. Again,
but it's out there.
I can go off stuff that's online that it's a follow up to Moon, but it's not direct. It's a loose follow up to Moon.
Yeah.
Again, I'm a massive fan of Duncan Jones, fan of Moon, a massive fan of everyone we've listed there. So that must be an exciting one to be part of.
Yeah,
right?
It's still ongoing.
Yeah.
Hence my blonde locks.
Amazing.
But it's incredibly exciting.
Yeah.
It's amazingly exciting. And that's, it really is. It's
due out next year at some point, I'd imagine.
Yeah, yeah. It's a Netflix production.
Oh, really? Mm. I didn't even I realised that. It's an exciting climate at the moment, man.
It's changing Netflix massively.
And all of, I think the BBC and for digital stuff is opening the world up to so much more risk-taking in TV, in film and everything. Yeah. Whereas before, you had to be so worried of, it's going to be on Friday night at 8 o'clock. Is this right for it? Is this right for that market?
Mm.
Whereas now, everyone's, and particularly with Netflix, they seem to be able to go, fuck it, let's make it, let's make it, and it will find its audience.
That's their manifesto.
Not overworked. Yeah,
yeah. But it's true. It's like,
on a big wall, on the wall, on a whiteboard in Netflix offices, just says, fuck it.
Duncan Jones comes in. So what do you think?
Fuck it.
But it's true. I bumped into Simon Amstell the other day, and he's directing something for iPlayer. So now there's content.
Yeah.
Being directed specifically, so BBC are maybe taking more of the Netflix model on board.
I love it. I think there was a lot of campaigns against it, but I think one of the best things that happened was BBC Three going digital.
Yeah.
Because I think it was the BBC's thought of, oh, let's fuck it off over there, but it's forced them into the future. Because the BBC can be a bit slow in progressing and moving forward. Obviously, they're a traditional institute, but I think it's going to be the best thing for them, because there's so many more shows that they can just go, let's try it out. If it works, it will go on demand, or we'll swing it on two in the middle of the night, or whatever else.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah, they have the possibility of lashing out so much more content.
Yeah,
hopefully good. Yeah,
excellent. Well, thank you very much for coming in. I'll wrap it up there.
Thank you, dear.
Where can people keep up to date on everything you? What's the best?
I don't know. This
Are you
podcast?
A lover of social media? Are you a lover of social media? Are you for or against?
I'm on Twitter, but you know, as I say, Twitter for me, it's a bit like an old dusty attic. You know, I kind of go up there every now and again.
Every now and then, have a look around,
move stuff around. I follow you on Twitter.
Excellent, good
and,
fun.
And you're very active on there. You and Rufus Hound, you make up most of my Twitter stream.
Yeah, we like to be keep it all busy and active. I'm easing up on Twitter, man. I had my Twitter hacked a few weeks back,
really?
And they stole it for like 3 days. And in those 3 days, I was like, you know what? If I don't get it back, I don't think I'm going to bother. I generally had one of the moments. I've spent years, particularly as independent label, independent artists, all these things, it's been important to build up my Twitter following. It's been a key bit of interaction with people.
Yeah.
And I did just kind of think, fuck it.
Manifesto.
It's become the theme of this podcast, the mantra, but it was one of them. I was like,
did they post anything?
They didn't. That's the weirdest thing. They stole it. They removed my photo, changed the name of it, but didn't do any tweets.
If I hacked your Twitter, I would like immediately post a picture of a tiny penis.
Mate,
and say it's mine.
I mean, I post that anyway. Yours. But I was so pleased I didn't have any dirty DMs. As genuine as, like, the only thing they could possibly get is my hidden secrets. I'm too boring at the moment in my life that I didn't have any. But honestly, I kind of sat there and went, 8 years' work, but kind of tired.
How many followers do you have?
I've got about 110,000, I think, which again, I've hustled for, but it's weird. As social media is a weird beast. I'm not on either side of it. I understand those who are addicted to it, and I understand those who go, nah, man, I want to focus on the art and what I'm doing as an artist and as an entertainer or whatever.
Yeah. I've become really addicted to the news recently, which I never have been.
Yeah.
I think it's because of the American election.
You're a sadist. I was going to say, you've chosen the worst time to become addicted to the horrendous news that we've got.
Horrendous, but really, I mean, throughout the, you know, not that I'm saying that it was worth it all for this, but there's been incredibly exciting.
On. Yeah, 100%.
And it is, it's ongoing. There's an excitement to it at the moment. I mean, it is like incredibly terrible news.
It was fascinating to see the impact on the entertainment industry because all, particularly in America, all viewing figures across the board were down during the election because so many people were focused on the news and on the debates and things like that. And it got to the point where people were like, we can't program anything when the debates are on, or we have to adjust our programming or edit an episode to make it a not as important episode and stuff like that, because it's literally
there was like literally no difference between the news and a reality TV show. There was zero difference,
including the reality TV stars being at the forefront of the news,
saying outlandish, bonkers, absurd things.
I do completely agree though, it's a fascinating time. Beat ourselves up and be depressed or whatever, but that's not going to change any of it.
No.
It does feel like one of those, strap in and witness this and be part of history, I guess. I had Danny Wallace on the podcast. One of the things that blew me away in that chat was he was saying when he was young, his dad was a journalist. And just before the Berlin Wall went down, he said he sat down, his mum, or Danny's mum, he didn't sat down his own mum. That was weird. he sat down Danny's mum and the family and said, look, we're moving to Berlin because history's happening.
Oh, wicked.
And we need to be part of that. And again, there's good history, there's bad history going on there, but it was like, it's important that we're part of this. And no matter how depressed you are about everything that's going on, we're all fucking part of some
world-shaping shit.
So it's a fascinating time, really. But that's a good point to wrap it up, as we've kind of made positive out of that.
Political at the end. Brilliant.
Thank you very much for chatting. It's been a pleasure to chat and a pleasure to finally meet and have a chinwag, because we've been discussing this for a while, haven't we? And putting something together. So I'm glad it's finally
around.
Happened.
Yeah.
Jet Trash, December 9th in View Cinemas, I believe. So check it out. And thank you.
Blood, sweat and tears. You'll see it all on the screen.
Damn right. Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobish Pips, the Splashed Pieces.
There we go, Mr. Robert Sheehan. A great chat. How friendly and warm was he? It was weird for me because I'm a massive fan of Misfits, and his character in Misfits in particular is fantastic. So I was very excited to meet this gentleman, and was blown away at how honest and open, how willing to discuss anything he was, even things he may not have been meant to be discussing too much, potentially, possibly, maybe. Thank you for tuning in, guys. I'll see you all next week. If you can like and subscribe and stuff like that, it really helps. It's something that you can do for free. Yeah, and spread the word. If you're enjoying the podcasts, spread the word. If you want to go and spend a bit of money on merch, that never hurts. You know, that's always a nice thing to do. So feel free to go and do that at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Other than that, thank you for tuning in. I will see you next week. Ta-ta.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.